All right, let's begin. Good morning. Nice to see everyone here this morning. The dramatic return of the Jewish people to their ancestral homeland in the early part of the 20th century raised questions of halakha that for 2,000 years we could only dream of. One of them, or among the questions, was, can we build a modern democracy in our ancient land? What should be the form of government here in the land of Israel? The Torah, after all, in Parashat Shoftim, instructs us, Som tasim alecha melech, you shall place a king upon you. And as you have here in the source sheet, source number one, it's one of the mitzvot, according to the Rambam, that the Jewish people must fulfill upon entering into the land. The Rambam writes in the first chapter of the Laws of Kings, here in source number one, it's Hilchot Malachim Perek Aleph Halacha Aleph. Shalosh mitzvot nitzdavu Yisrael b'shat knisatan la'aretz. The Jewish people, or Israel, was commanded with three mitzvot upon entry into the land. The first one is Lemanot lahem melech, to appoint a king over them. Shne'emar, as the pasuk says, which I just quoted, Som tasim alecha melech. Ulachrit zar'o shel amalek. The second one is to destroy the seed or offspring of Amalek. As it says, Shne'emar, Timchet zecher Amalek. You shall wipe out the memory of Amalek. And the third mitzvah is Vilivnot beit ha-bechira, and to build the holy temple, the chosen house of God. Shne'emar, as it says, Lishichno tidrashu. So three mitzvot, the first among them is to appoint a king. Is monarchy the only form of government according to the Torah? That was the question that was asked before the founding of the state of Israel. And if monarchy is the only option, well, doesn't the king have to come from the tribe of Judah? Shevet Yudan. Doesn't the king have to come from the Davidic line, the Davidic dynasty, Malchut Beit David? Are other forms of government allowed according to the Torah? And as we'll see, in order to appoint a king, right, not just does the king have to come from the tribe of Judah and the line of David, which might be hard to identify, although there are families that do have traditions that they are descendants of King David, but the king has to be appointed by a Sanhedrin, a high court, we're going to be talking about that, please God, next week. A Supreme Court, which has to be not just, you know, rabbis who studied in Yeshiva University or some yeshiva here in Israel, but they have to be real smuchim, which we'll talk about next week. They have to have real smicha, real ordination, an unbroken chain from Moshe. And we don't have that today. Maybe we can reinstitute that or reinstate that, revive that. We'll see next week if that's possible. But we don't have a Sanhedrin, and a king must be appointed by a Sanhedrin, and a king must be appointed by a Navi, a prophet, and we no longer have prophets. So how can we appoint a king? And what can we do and what should we do? Here we've returned to our land. We want to create a government. What's permissible? So that's our question this morning. And I'd like to, I'm sorry? It's a question already. You have a question already. I didn't even get started. Yes, please, Rabbi.
Well, we have it three times before. We had it with Joshua to the land. We had the question. We had it when Ezra came back.
Okay.
Rav Kook addressed these questions too.
Okay. Very good. So we're going to explore together this morning an important tshuva of Rav Kook, where he addresses this very topic and tackles this very issue. And the truth is that Rav Kook wasn't the only one. There were others who addressed this issue and tried to justify creating a modern government in our ancient homeland. There's the famous Rabbi Chaim Hirschenson, who was a rabbi here in the land of Israel. Ultimately, he emigrated to the United States and became the rabbi. I grew up in New Jersey, so if you know New Jersey, became the rabbi of Hudson County, Union City, Jersey City, Hoboken, that whole area there around the Lincoln Tunnel, if you know New Jersey. You know the Lincoln Tunnel. There's a famous rabbi, Rabbi Chaim Hirschenson. It was actually a very unique rabbinic personality. He worked together with Eliezer ben Yehuda at reviving the Hebrew language. People think, you know, the Hebrew language was revived in modern times by secular Zionists. It's a trefa language. You can't speak it. Eliezer ben Yehuda himself looked to rabbinic literature, Mishnaic Hebrew, the Hebrew in the Talmud and Midrash, the Hebrew of the Rambam, and consulted with rabbis, among them, principally Rabbi Chaim Hirschenson. Anyway, he was a controversial rabbi, and the Zealots, in a sense, forced him out of Israel. He ended up living in the United States, but even though he was in the West, his heart was in the East, and he wrote a whole series of responsa called Malki B'Kodesh, and among most of the issues that he tackles there in his multi-volume work, Malki B'Kodesh, is how to create a modern democracy here in the state of Israel. This is all pre-state. He's heavily influenced by de Tocqueville. It's a fascinating work. But this morning, I'd like to look together with you at this famous tshuva of Rav Kook, because I think that it's very telling for a number of reasons, and we'll see why this morning. So if you take a look at the bottom of the page, it's source number 3. This is a tshuva of Rav Kook that appears in his Mishpat Kohen. It's a very lengthy tshuva. We're just going to look at one section of it. It's a tshuva that's very important and deals with issues of pikuach nefesh, risk in terms of saving Jewish life, a lot of issues related to the laws of engaging in battle and warfare. So it's a very relevant tshuva, and a lot has been written on this tshuva. But he also, in one section, tackles this very issue. Can we establish a modern democracy in our ancient land, and how do we do that, and what gives us the right? Do we have the authority to do that? And it's interesting. We'll see. He draws from the period of the Hashmonaim, okay, from the Hasmoneans, from the Maccabees, in order to justify establishing a modern sovereign nation and a modern government in our ancient land, and we'll see why that's important this morning. And so it's absolutely a fascinating tshuva. So we're only going to look at a section of it together this morning. But I encourage all of you for homework, for Shiri Bayit, to look at the entire tshuva, if you're so inspired. This is a tshuva that Rav Kook writes in 1916 when he's in St. Gallen, Switzerland. We know that Rav Kook traveled to participate in Agudat Yisrael's Knesset Gdolah, and because of the outbreak of World War I, got stuck in Europe. So this he's writing in 1917 when in St. Gallen, Switzerland. And while he was there, he was in close contact with a Swiss rabbi by the name of Shlomo Zalman Pines. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Pines was a prolific author, wrote many svarim, and wrote many letters to Rav Kook. We have a lot of Rav Kook's responses to Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Pines. And during this time, there was a major controversy taking place here in the land of Israel, pre-state. Following the second Aliyah, which was a mass migration to the land of Israel, there were civil defense groups that were created in order to defend the Yishuv, to protect the Yishuv. Good morning. Good morning. If you're just coming in now, we have some source sheets, if you like. First, there was Nili, or Netzach Yisrael Lo Yishaker. Then there was Bar Giora. And after Bar Giora, there was a group called Hashomer. I put a picture of the members of Hashomer. Hashomer was active between the years 1909 and 1920. Here on the bottom of page 2 is a picture of Hashomer. The most famous among the members was Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, who became the second president of the State of Israel. Following the dismantling of Hashomer in 1920, its members went on to form the Palmach and the Haganah. Okay? But before the Palmach and the Haganah and the Lehi and the Etzel and all of these underground groups, you had these Irgunei Tzvaim, Irgunei Shmirah v'Haganah, these militias, these civil defense groups that were created in order to protect the Yishuv. But there was a lot of hitnagdut, there was a lot of controversy and opposition to these by rabbis. There were rabbis who questioned whether we have the authority to create civil defense groups or militias without a king and without a Sanhedrin. We know that in order to go to battle, you need the authority of a king, a Sanhedrin. And we don't have a king, and we don't have a center. How can we create these civil defense groups, these militias? And I'm sorry?
It's defense.
It's defense. Okay. Pashut, nefesh. And we'll see that. You know, Rav Kook will say that. Okay. But surprisingly, there were rabbis who were against these groups. They felt that we do not have the halachic authority to create these groups. Maybe there's a difference, you can argue, between pikuach nefesh, defending oneself as individuals, versus an organized tzava. Okay, and the laws of Milchama are relegated to the Malchut and to the Sanhedrin. Okay, but it's a good point you make. It's a good point you raise. What are we supposed to just sit back and sit on our hands and let them kill us? Chas v'shalom. Absolutely.
No, that's
what they allowed people to argue. Shkem lahargo. We have. Right, so it's almost surprising, but there were rabbis at the time who opposed the formation of these militias. So Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Pines writes to Rav Kook and asks him this question. And Rav Kook answers this question, and one of his answers is along the lines of what you're saying. Of course, barur, that we have an obligation to protect ourselves. But then he continues on, and as we'll see, drawing from the Chashmonaim, writes that we have, based on this authority, to create a government, a sovereign nation, a government in our ancestral homeland. Okay? So let's look at the tshuva here at the bottom of source number 3. Umashe katav, kvod torato harama, what the great exalted Torah leader wrote. Okay, it's an honorific. Te'im milchamot mishpat hamluchahin, that if wars, if fighting and battles and wars are part of the mishpat hamlucha, relegated to the authority of the king, eich milchamu hachashmonaim kineged chayalot Surya below melech. How do the Chashmonaim fight against the Syrian forces, the Yevanim, the Seleucids, without a king? Okay, now ultimately they restored Jewish sovereignty and they became the kings, the Chashmonaim, but there was a period that there was no king at the time. Hine al milchama ha-yisodit shel ha-chashmonaim shaita b'yichud neged ha-shmad v'sha'at ha-gzeira shel ha-yevanim v'ashkicham toratecha u'lavira michukei ritzonecha al zeh ein ma lishol b'chlal. If we're talking about the wars that the Chashmonaim waged against the Seleucids, who wanted to destroy their religion, who wanted to create all sorts of decrees against the religion, who wanted to make them forget Torah, and to draw them away from the laws of Hashem's will, so on that there's nothing to ask. It's very simple, along the lines of what you said. Koach nefesh. Right? Shmad. We have to protect our life. We have to protect our religion. Shari gam al mitzvah kala yahareg v'al yavor. The Talmud in Masechet Sanhedrin teaches that even if they want to change a tiny or small little mitzvah during a time of shmad, when religion is in danger, when there's an attack on our Judaism, one must give up their life. And the Gemara continues and asks, what's an example of a mitzvah kala? Even changing one's shoelace, the Gemara says. If religion is under attack and they've made decrees to destroy Judaism, then one is not even allowed to change his shoelace if the Roman or the Greek wants him to change his shoelace. The eich lo tia reshut, the gam chova litchazek bilchama. How could there not be permission? And more than that, obligation to strengthen oneself, to strengthen themselves in war. In other words, of course, if it's a time of shmad, when religion is under attack, we have a right to defend ourselves, and not just that, we have an obligation to defend ourselves. Kidei levatel et koach hashmad ulahamid et klalot hadat al tila, in order to destroy the strength of the decrees and to restore the Torah, to restore the religion on its hill, so to speak, to restore our religion, to protect our religion. V'al ha-milchamot haba'ot achar kein. And so, okay, so, all right, once you now have restored Jewish sovereignty, can you still wage war? He asks. So then he continues and says, and upon the wars that follow, shegam ha-milachim ha-ksheirim shebehem milchamu, which the kings, the kosher kings among them, waged. And we're going to come back to this idea, because we know that the Chashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, while they did manage to restore Jewish sovereignty, and they waged war against the Seleucid Greeks and those Jews who had become Hellenized. It's interesting. You know, we think of this battle of Hanukkah as just, you know, the Jews versus the Greeks. That's what we're taught in school. But it was also the Jews versus Jews who had Hellenized. Take a look at the book of the Maccabees, for instance. You see that it was a civil war. It was a war against Hellenized Jews as well. And then unfortunately, what happened was, over time, the Chashmonaim themselves fell victim to the same Hellenism that they had initially fought against. They became Hellenized. So that's why Rav Kook is using this language, the kosher kings among them, the Melachim HaKsherim, because as he's going to address shortly, subsequently, the Chashmonaim became Hellenized, and they weren't such great kings. And there were political assassinations, and they slaughtered many Jews subsequently. If we take at least Josephus' account of Alexander Yanai as the truth, as fact, there were some very, very wicked Hasmonean kings. And fundamentally, Rav Kook is going to have to address the fact that they were not from the tribe of
Judah,
right? They were Kohanim from the tribe of Levi. They did not come from the Davidic dynasty. So he says, well, you know, initially the kosher kings among them fought these subsequent wars. As halu kvar hayu melachim meumadim al pi haskamat ha'uma. These subsequent kings were kings that were appointed by the agreement of the nation, the haskamat ha'uma. And this is very important. And Rav Kook is going to come back to this idea that it's through the agreement of the nation that the nation, the ummah, the klal, the Jewish people as an entity have a certain power, have a certain authority to appoint a king on top of them to rule over them, even when other factors are not met, even when the situation is less than ideal. And we'll see that this is a theme in the thought of Rav Kook, that the ummah, the klal, the Jewish people as a body, have a certain power, have a certain zgula, have a certain koach, according to Rav Kook. But here he continues and says that Amnam yesh ledayek milashon harambam beperek aleph demelachim halachachet shekatav navi shemid melech mishar shifte Yisrael v'yahu to amelech holech b'derech haTorah v'amitzva v'nilcham milchamot Hashem harei zeh melech v'chol mitzvot hamalchut nohagot bo. He says that the Rambam rules, and here I've put this in source number one, you can take a look at it, that there are certain times when a king can be appointed from other nations, from other tribes, excuse me, not other nations, from other tribes. If a king cannot be appointed from the tribe of Judah, okay, a king can be appointed from one of the other tribes. And as long as, I'll take your question in a moment, and as long as, the Rambam writes, he follows in the ways of the Torah, that king is the king for all intents and purposes. And then Rav Kook continues, but that is so long as that king was appointed by a Navi. Mm-hmm. Right? He says that that king is Hareza Melech, he's a king, v'chol mitzvot ha-malchut nohagot bo, shedafka al pi navi, hu, dehavei melech, because it was dafka through the appointment of a navi, v'lo al pi haskamat ha-uma b'lo navi, but not through the consensus of the people without a navi. U'bizman ha-chashmonaim kfar paska ha-nevua mikfar, but during the times of the chashmonaim, there was no longer nevuah. There was no longer prophecy. The last three prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, had ascended with the Jewish people from Babel to Eretz Israel. But this was already much later. And so there was no longer prophecy. So how can you appoint a king from one of the other tribes? Okay. Yes, I'll take your question. Please.
Okay. But it says in the Torah that if you're going to have a king, you should write a sefer Torah.
Sure, there are certain mitzvot that apply to the king. Okay.
All right. Well, did the Hashmonaim kings write sefer Torahs?
That's a great question. There are certain mitzvot that apply to the king. What the Hashmonaim did, I don't know. We don't have a record of whether they wrote a sefer Torah or not. I don't know. I don't know. But we do know that the first kings were good kings who restored Jewish sovereignty and seemingly were righteous, but then subsequently, as I mentioned, they succumbed. That's the word I was looking for. They succumbed to the same Hellenism that they tried to fight in the first place. So now Rav Kook is going to justify, well, then how did the Hashmonaim, what gave them the right to become king if there was no Navi. Okay? And we'll see how Rav Kook builds this. Again, he's first going to try to justify how the Chashmonaim were able to do this in a less than ideal situation. And then he's going to use that as a springboard to address our question. Well, what about today? Right? Yeah?
Who says that it has to be chosen by a Navi?
So that's the Rambam here.
The Rambam sometimes?
That's the Rambam here. Well, let's just say that's Rav Kook's interpretation of the Rambam as he reads the Rambam here.
It's not specific.
The Rambam. So the Rambam writes here in Halacha Gimel, Perek Aleph Halacha Gimel, source number one. Ein mamidin melech batchila ela alpi beitin shel shivim zekenim ve'alpi navi. Okay. That's in Halacha Gimel. That's Perek Aleph Halacha Gimel, chapter one, Halacha three. Then the Rambam subsequently writes here in Perek Hey, the fifth chapter, Halacha Aleph, Ein mamidin melech el alpi beitin shel shivim ve'echad. And what does he leave out? The Navi. So Rav Kook is going to try and address that seeming contradiction and reconcile that. So it's good that you pointed that out. But lechatchila, it would seem that you must have a Navi. Okay? And what Rav Kook is saying is dafka, when you're appointing a king from another tribe, you require a Navi. There must be a Navi. Okay? But you'll see what he writes and how he reconciles the fact that the Chashmonaim reigned. Because seemingly they usurped the throne from the tribe of Judah and from the Davidic dynasty, from the Davidic line. So he continues and writes, V'chein katav v'alacha gimel sham. This is what the Rambam writes in Halacha Gimel, which I just read, Ein ma'midim melech betchila el al pi beitin shel shivim zekenim ve'al pi navi. You cannot appoint a king at the beginning unless you have 70 elders, a Sanhedrin, right, and a Navi, a prophet. Dimashma ditarvaihu be'inan beitin shel shivim zekenim ve'gam navi. Mashma, the implication is that we require both. The implication is that we require both. We require a Beit Din of 70 Zekenim, which is a Sanhedrin, and we require a Navi, a prophet. Oh. But one may say, and this is where Rav Kook's creativity comes in as a posek. You know, people talk about Rav Kook as, you know, what a creative thinker he was, what a progressive thinker he was. They talk about the creativity and the originality in his thought, in his philosophy. But what people don't realize, he was also a very creative posek. Often very conservative in his piskei halacha. But with things related to the nation of Israel, like this tshuva here, very creative how he understands the Rambam. So what he says is, when the Rambam says that you need to have, in order to appoint a king, you need to have a Sanhedrin, and you need to have a Navi, Rav Kook says, yes, that's lechatchila. That's in the ideal. But there's the ideal, and then there's the reality in the thought of Rav Kook. So he writes, that's the ideal. D'lechatchilahi mitzvah bekach. This is Hayav Shalom Lomar, we can suggest that that's lechatchila. Aval im hemidu Yisrael melech belo navi, gam kein hareze melech lechol mitzvot hamalchut. Wow. But if the Jewish people appoint a king over them without a navi, without a prophet, he is still the king for all intents and purposes. Lechol mitzvot hamalchut. All the laws of kingship apply to this king, to this individual. And now we can reconcile the stira, the apparent contradiction in the Rambam. You know, every good halacha shir has to try and reconcile some stira in the Rambam, right? Some apparent contradiction in the Rambam. And as I showed you, in the first chapter, the Rambam writes, you need a Sanhedrin and you need a prophet, a Navi. In the fifth chapter, the Rambam writes, you need a Sanhedrin. He leaves out what?
The Navi.
Why? Rav Kook suggests, because in the fifth chapter, he's speaking about the Bidyavid. The Bidyavid, Bidyavad. There's the ideal, and then there's the less than ideal, or the reality. So, if you have a Navi, you need a Navi to appoint a king. But what happens when you don't have a Nevi? He writes that the Chashmonim, during the period of the Chashmonim, there were no Nevi'im. There was no longer Nevuah. And so the sort of cook will reconcile this contradiction in the Rambam. He says, now we can understand and reconcile. He doesn't mention a Navi. The Rambam doesn't mention a Navi in the fifth chapter of Hilchot Sanhedrin. Because Bidiavad, post facto, he is the king, even without a prophet. But in Halacha Chet of Hilchot Melachim, Shekatav Lashon B'diavad Navi Shemid Mashma Degam B'diavad Eifshar Lamid Melech Belo Navi Ve'en Lo Din Melech. In other words, when you have a Navi, so then you are not allowed to appoint a king without a Navi. But when you don't have a Navi, you have the right to appoint a king. V'tzarich Lomar D'Bizman She'yesh Navi B'Yisrael Gam B'diavad Ein Melech Omed Belo Navi Aval K'she'ein Navi As mamidim al pi beit din hagadol. When you don't have a prophet, you can appoint a king through the authority of the beit din hagadol, the Sanhedrin, the 70 or 71 elders. Okay, so you have the ideal according to Rav Kook, and you have the reality. And Rav Kook is basing this on the Rambam. He's using the authority of the Rambam to reconcile the fact that we can appoint a king over us even without a prophet. But okay, but they had a Sanhedrin, but we don't even have a Sanhedrin today, right? Although there is a body that calls themselves the Sanhedrin, and they're trying to restore the Sanhedrin and restore real smicha, and that's, you know, a very bold move and a courageous move. Unfortunately, they don't have the haskama of the ummah. They don't have the authority of the nation. But Rav Kook now will go on to try and reconcile. What if you don't even have a Sanhedrin, like today? Okay, do we have the authority to create a government? So take a look where I've underlined next. So now he addresses the criticism of the Ramban. The Ramban is very critical of the Chashmonaim. The Ramban in his Perush, the end of Sefer Breishit, on the Pasuk, Lo Yasur Shevet Mi'Yehuda, that the scepter shall never leave the tribe of Judah. The Ramban is very critical and asks, how did the Chashmonaim usurp the throne?
What about Shaul?
Well, it's a good question. Shaul was appointed, after all, by Shmuel Hanavi, by a prophet. Okay, but I don't want to get into Shaul. That's a different story. I want to focus here on the Chashmonaim, but it's a good question. So here the Chashmonaim didn't have a Navi to appoint them king. Right? And not only that, they usurped the throne from the tribe of Judah and from the house of David, from Malchut Beit David, from the Davidic line, the Davidic throne. How did they do that? And the Ramban is very critical. And he writes that that's why ultimately they met such a devastating end. They died in battle, and then ultimately they were taken over by King Herod, who was the last of the Chashmonaim. He cites a horrible story about King Herod that appears in the Gemara. The Ramban is very critical of the Chashmonaim. He writes that they had no authority to do that, to usurp the throne from the tribe of Judah, from Malchut Beit David. And he says, he goes as far as to say they even desecrated their kahuna. The Torah tells the Kohen that he's supposed to protect his kahuna, his priesthood. And the Talmud, based on that, says that we're not supposed to appoint Kohanim as kings. So according to the Ramban, they also desecrated their kahuna. The Ramban is very critical of the Chashmonaim. Now Rav Kook will explain the Ramban's criticism in a different way. Take a look at the bottom of the page. It says, "V'zahaya inyan malchut beit Chashmonai." This is the matter, or this is how the Chashmonaim had the authority to become king. Umash shekedav Ramban, and what the Ramban writes, "She'asu lo shekaru'i, ala she'lo hichziru hamalchut lebeit David." So what the Ramban writes, that they didn't do what was appropriate because they didn't restore the kingship to the house of David. Certainly they should have tried to do so. Now it's interesting, the Ramban does not write that. This is Rav Kook's interpretation of the Ramban. Rav Kook here is explaining that maybe why the Ramban is so angry, because after all, as we saw in the Rambam, you can appoint a king from the other nations. After all, King Shaul, as you mentioned, was not from the tribe of Judah. You can appoint a king from the other nations when necessary. Okay? After King David, it has to come from the Davidic dynasty, but in a time when you have to act, right? It's a horat sha'ah. You don't have a choice. Maybe they had to. Rav Kook is saying, basically, that the Hashmonaim weren't such bad guys, right? Matityahu Kohen Gadol, right? Yehuda HaMakabi, these were very great people. How could you suggest that they did something wrong? Well, what Rav Kook says is, maybe it wasn't so bad that they became king because they had no other choice. No one was standing up, right? It was an eight lasot lashem, a time to act for God. Hefiru Torah. They were going to destroy the Torah. The Torah was going to be lost. It was going to be destroyed. They had no other choice. It was a horat shah. They had to act. But what Rav Kook is explaining, maybe what the Ramban is critical of, is the fact that they did not then return the kingship to the house of David once things were peaceful and calm. That's how Rav Kook understands the criticism of the Ramban. But, as I said, that's not in the language of the Ramban. Yes?
Were they appointed by Sanhedrin?
Not clear. Not clear. So he writes the following. He says, we'll see what Rav Kook writes, but he writes the following. He says, "Bivadai ra'ui lishtadel bazeh." Certainly they should have tried to restore the kingdom to the Davidic line once there was peace in the land. V'imulai hayta bazeh ha'akava b'tzad ha'malchiyot ha'moshlot az aleihem. And if there was some sort of ha'akava, some sort of thing that would prevent them from restoring the kingdom to the Davidic line, so it's ha'ya ra'ui lidvarav al kol panim limno milikabel machut lechatchila. He says, and maybe they should have never accepted the kingdom or the throne to begin with. Okay, again, he's trying to defend the Hashmonaim and explain away the criticism of the Ramban. He's saying that really, by making themselves king, that wasn't so bad. There was no other choice. But maybe what they did wrong was that they didn't restore the throne to the Davidic line after things were peaceful. And if they saw that there would have been some sort of prevention from preventing them, or not something that wouldn't allow them to restore the throne to the Davidic line, then maybe they should not have accepted the throne to begin with.
Maybe it did happen, we didn't know it. Just, there's no record of it. You know, we know the facts that it did, but we don't know when it went into it. They try and...
That's true. Okay, that's a good point. That's a good point. We don't know. You're right. You're right that Rav Kook here is suggesting something that, you know, we don't really have the evidence for either way. Okay? He's speaking now just conjecture. He's like, and if maybe they saw that they could not have restored the throne, they should never accept it upon themselves in the first place. This is just conjecture. Okay, he's just dealing theoretically with this, but I hear what you're saying. Aval mikol makom, but nevertheless, kishem nuhu Yisrael, bahaskamat Sanhedrin. Oh, so here, in answer to your question, according to Rav Kook, it must have been through the haskamat Sanhedrin. We don't have a record of that, right? Again, you know, what we have about the Hashmonaim is minimal, and it's also subject to much controversy and much, you know, discussion. As to the authority of the books of the Maccabees and the scroll of the Hashmonaim.
And Yehuda Hanasi told us nothing.
Right. Dafkai, I once spoke here about the fact, why is there, I think it was over Hanukkah, before Hanukkah, why is there no Masechet Chanukah, right? Why is there very minimal information in the Mishnah and the Gemara about Hanukkah in general and about the Hashmonaim in particular? And there are a lot of really interesting suggestions, but according to Rav Kook, at least they were appointed by the Haskamah of the Sanhedrin. That's what he writes. Aval mikol makom kishimnu Yisrael b'haskamat Sanhedrin. When Israel, but it's interesting the way he phrases it. When Israel appointed them through the agreement of the Sanhedrin, when Israel appointed them, and that's significant because he's going to talk about the power that Israel, the people of Israel, have to appoint a government over themselves. Shera'u Gam king shesh tzorich badavar. They saw that there was a need. Okay. V'ulay ra'u shebelo ezratam shalach hashmonim shezachu l'tiferet gedula b'uma. And maybe they saw that without the assistance of the hashmonim, he parenthetically says, who were zoche, who merited the great glory of the nation, the Rambam, Maimonides waxes poetic about how great they were and how they restored Jewish sovereignty and they were, you know, amazing leaders. At least the early ones, maybe. Mitzad ma'aseh ha'magdolim v'kdushat chasidutam v'toratam ha'merubah. So here, you know, you see Rav Kook is following along the way the Rambam, which is not on your sheets, but you can take a look at it. It's in the laws of Chanukah. The Rambam talks about the greatness of the Hashmonaim. He says, you know, they were great individuals and did great acts and were holy and were righteous and were pious. And he says, lo yav shar lamid melech mi beit din al kein skimu gam hem al haminu shelahem the note vilo nechshav ze lesanedrin ledavar sheinu ra'ui gam adat ramban kim hashmonim atzmam sheem ayu cholim lishtadel badavar al pi haskamat ha'uma. Again, this idea of the haskamat ha'uma, okay, that the nation has this authority to appoint a king over itself.
And the reason we're delving into this is to try to set a precedent.
Exactly. Exactly. Rav Kook sees the Hashmonaim, and this is important. We'll have to ask what the significance of this is. But Rav Kook sees the Hashmonaim as a paradigm for creating a sovereign nation in our ancestral homeland in a less than ideal situation. Okay, I'm gonna come back to that.
Why not? The circumstance happened 2,000 years before. It's a good reason.
Right, it's a precedent. So here Rav Kook is drawing upon us, but we haven't gotten there yet. Right now he's just justifying how they did it. And now he's going to continue and explain or justify how we have the authority to do so. Okay? V'chutz mizenirim advarim, where I've underlined next. And additionally, not just that, but shebizman shein melech, at a time when there is no king, kevan shemishpitei hamlucha, this is very important. Since the laws of the king concern directly the life of the nation, the rights of kingship, the rights of governance, of sovereignty, return to the hands of the ummah. Bichlala, okay, in their entirety. When there is no king, okay, no prophet, no Sanhedrin, and now no king, no nothing, what do? Do you just, is there just anarchy? He writes that since the laws of the king are directly related to the needs, to the life of the nation, so the authority of governance returns to the ummah, to the nation. Okay, now that's a very important line. Ubi yichud, and specifically near shegam kol shofet shekam b'Yisrael, din melech yeshlo le'inyan kam mishpatei hamlucha. Ubi yichud l'mash nogea l'hanagat hakla. Also, a very, very important line. And specifically, it appears that any judge, now he uses the word judge, but replace that with leader. Any leader that rises up in Israel has the law of a king concerning li'inyan kama mishpatei hamlucha, concerning a number of the laws related to king. U'biyichud l'mash shenogea l'hanagat haklal, and specifically things that are related to the governance of the klal, of the nation. Wow. So Rav Kook says two very important things here. Number one, when there is no Navi, and there is no Sanhedrin, and there is no king, the authority to appoint a government returns to the nation of the people, and they can appoint a government over themselves through the Haskamat Ha'uma, as we saw before, through the consensus or agreement of the nation. Maybe we're talking about democracy here, the democratic process.
Sounds like
time of service. Okay. And not just that, but the government or the individual that they choose to reign over them has the authority of a king. Okay, we're going to come back to that idea because that maybe is potentially dangerous. Right? But here Rav Kook is justifying how we can create a sovereign government, a sovereign nation, in our ancestral homeland. Remember, he's writing this in 1916. And he reiterates again, Avalamash nogela hanagata klal, kol shemanhigeta uma danhu bimishpeteham lucha, shehem klal tzarcheha uma hadrushim l'shatam v'lema'amad ha'olam. Anything that's concerning the governance, the hanhaga of the klal, any ruler that rules, any leader that rules, okay, he does so through the authority of the laws of kings, which, again, are there in order to provide for the needs of the nation. Okay, so there's no such thing as saying, according to Rav Kook, well, we don't have a Navi, we don't have a Sanhedrin, we don't have a king, we don't have the authority to create a Jewish government. The opposite. He writes that we were now given the authority to create a Jewish government. And he continues towards the bottom where I've underlined, Vaday gam shoftim muskamim unisim klaliim b'makom melech heim omdim. Certainly, any judges or any nisim, leaders, presidents, okay, they stand b'makom melech. They are in place of the king. V'sad l'davar hu lashon ha-Rambam b'perek dalet Sanhedrin halacha yud gimel. He cites the Rambam again, that Roshe Galiot Sheba Bavel b'makom melech hein omdim. V'yesh lahem lirdot et Yisrael b'chol makom. The Resh Galuta, the head of the exiles, or the exilarch, which led the Jewish people in Bavel, okay, you had a type of Nasi. The Rambam writes that they stood in place of the king, meaning they were the ruler. They had for all intents and purposes, they were like the king, and they could exact punishment from Israel if necessary. They had the authority. And so then he writes, I'll take your question in a moment. The kal v'chomer shenisim hamuskamim ba'uma bizman shi be'artza uvishiltona be'ezo madrigashi. He says, kal v'chomer, all the more so, a nasi who was appointed through the authority of the nation, at a time when the Jewish people are in their land and have sovereignty, be'ezo madrega shehi. Now this is a very important line. What does he mean, be'ezo madrega shehi? What does that mean, be'ezo madrega? At whatever level they're at, meaning whatever level the Jewish people are at, whatever the level the leader's at, even if it's not an ideal circumstance, like the Hashmonaim. By the way, the halacha is to appoint an exilarch or a nasi from the tribe of Judah, from Malchut Beit David, if possible, because again, they stand in place of the king, as Rav Kook writes. So here he's saying that if a leader that's appointed by the people in Bavel has the authority, like a king, to rule over the Jewish people, kal v'chomer, when the Jewish people are in their land and have sovereignty. Okay? Yes, what did you want to ask? A good question. It's not so clear. I'll just add that, and I'm sure it would depend on the time, but I'll just add that, you know, if you take a look at the language Rav Kook uses, he says, be'ezo madrega shehi, at whatever level they're at, meaning even if it's not an ideal situation, if there's a ruler, they have the status of king, or they're in place of the king. Because, and maybe this is an answer to your question, Rav Kook continues, because they were appointed bishvil hanagat ha'uma, in order to govern, in order to lead the nation. Lorak bikar bishvil harbatzat ha'torah, not just in order to teach Torah, to spread Torah. They're a political leader, if you will. But because they were appointed in order to lead the nation, they stand in place of the king. Aval otam, where I've underlined next, towards the bottom, aval otam shehu skamu. Ba'amaratam lechatchila bishvil ha'uma ben-hagadah ha'kalit gam artzit kimalchei beit chashmonai v'gam nisehim pshita delo griyei miroshei galuyot shebavel. And therefore, those who were appointed, again, to rule over the nation, to lead the nation, to lead the land, they are like chashmonaim, they were like the Hasmonean kings, v'gam nisehim, and like the nasi, the prince, or the head of the Sanhedrin, pshita delo griyei miroshei galuyot shebavel. It's simple that they're not any less than the exilarch in Bavel, who, as we said, according to the Rambam, stands in place of the king. And then he ends with a very important line, the bottom. Aval kishemit maneh manhig ha'uma l'kol tzarcheh b'signon malchuti. When you appoint a king, a leader, not a king, a leader, you appoint a political leader over the nation, a government, if you will, l'kol tzarcheh b'signon malchuti, for all of its needs, all the needs of the government, the governance or the leading of this nation, b'signon malchuti. That's important. B'signon malchuti. The style or like a king. Al pidat haklal, vidat beitin, through the authority of the klal and the beitin, if you have a Sanhedrin. Vaday omeidhu bimkom melech. Certainly he stands in place of the king. L'inyan mishpatei hamlucha, concerning the laws of the government, hanogaim lahanhagat haklal, which concern the governance of the klal, of the people. And that line opens up a Pandora's box. Because if you say that the government is just like the king, and all the laws of the king apply to the government, then maybe there's no room for any dissension or opposition. With this line, Rav Kook, in a sense, opens up a Pandora's box. Because if the government, if the Knesset, if the Rosh Memshalah are in place of the king, then maybe, if you don't listen to them, you're in violation of Moreid B'Malchut, of rebelling against the king, and someone who rebels against the king is Chayav Mita, is obligated in the death penalty. Moreid B'Malchut Chayav Mita. And there is a faction, if you will, in the religious Zionist community today that wants to interpret Rav Kook in this way and suggest that according to Rav Kook, any government here in the state of Israel has the authority of the king and their word is final. And so therefore you have to listen to them. And it's a Torah violation not to listen to them. And you're obligated by the Torah to listen to them because they are the king. And so this conflict peaked, if you will, during the Hitnatkut, during the disengagement, when you had rabbis that said, you must listen to the government, you must follow the orders, because they have the authority like a king. Now, I don't believe that was Rav Kook's intent in writing this. I believe that Rav Kook is trying to justify establishing a government. And when he writes that the government is in place of the king, he means that in place of the king in order to govern the people, but not that every law applies to the king, because he's trying to justify creating a democracy. And if you have to treat the government like a king, right, then it undermines the whole idea of democracy. And over again, Rav Kook uses this language of the haskamat ha'uma. It has to be through the consensus, through the agreement of the umma. That's what gives this governing body its authority. And he doesn't write that they are the king. He writes that it's besignon malchuti. It's the ke'ilu, a king. Like a king. Like a king. But not king. And he reiterates that their authority is concerning things that relate to governing the people. It would seem that Rav Kook implies is their authority is limited. They are not the king. Okay? Because if you say that they are the king, then there is no room for dissent. There is no room for different voices. There is no room for democracy. And it serves to undermine exactly what Rav Kook here is trying to justify. But yet, there is a faction in the religious Zionist community that are called the Mamlachtiim. Mamlachtiut. Okay? The Mamlachtiim, who believe that the government here, the state of Israel, the Rosh Memshalah, the Knesset, have the authority of a king, period. They are like the Jewish king for all intents and purposes. And they draw upon Rav Kook to justify their position. But I think that's very dangerous. But I think it's also significant that Rav Kook, as we saw, draws upon the period of the Hashmonaim in order to justify establishing a modern democracy in the state of Israel. Why do you think that's significant? Dafka the Hashmonaim. Any ideas, any suggestions? Yes?
Well, they were defending the land and they were defending the idea of being against foreign influences.
Okay. Okay. But what happened, as I mentioned, subsequently the Hashmonaim
failed.
They failed.
They became Eurotrash.
Well, Eurotrash, I don't know what that means. This is, we're talking, you know, over 2,000 years ago. I don't know that there was Eurotrash there. But they succumbed to the very Hellenism that they fought against. Okay? And there were all sorts of political assassinations. And Josephus describes how Alexander Yanai was killing all these Prushim, these... The religious segment of the population, the rabbis, the Tanaim, if you will, had them crucified in Jerusalem and had women and children murdered while he would eat and drink with his concubines. Just, you know, horrible, horrible descriptions if you take Josephus at face value. And this is who we're drawing upon to justify a Jewish sovereignty in our ancient homeland, creating a modern democracy, a modern government, the Hashmonaim. Is that, you know, who we really want to be looking towards? So I think it is significant because, as Rav Kook writes, there's the lichatchila and then there's the bidyevet. There's the ideal and then there's the reality. And I think it's significant that he draws upon the Hashmonaim because they were less than perfect, and maybe that's an understatement. But nevertheless, that's the best that they had at the time. So, you know, whether you're a fan of Bibi and Likud or not, whether, you know, you're a fan of... I'm sorry? So right, what would the other... What's the other alternative? And so I think it's significant, you know, that Rav Kook draws upon the Hashmonaim because we live here, we've been zocha, we've merited returning to our ancestral homeland after 2,000 years. We've been fortunate to build a state of our own. With all of its problems, we have to be realistic and pragmatic. But nevertheless, it's a tremendous blessing. It's really a tremendous blessing that we've been fortunate to come back to our ancestral homeland and create a democracy with all of its problems here in the state of Israel. We don't have to be naive. At the same time, we don't have to go into all of our problems. We describe the modern state of Israel in the Tefillah L'Shalom HaMedina, the prayer for the state of Israel, which we'll be looking at in a few weeks. We describe it as Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu, the first flowering of our redemption. And we'll look at that in a few weeks, where that comes from and who said that and what it means. But we don't describe it as Gulatenu, our redemption. We don't even describe it as Reshit Gulatenu, the beginning of our redemption. We describe it as the first flowering of our redemption. It's this double hedge. It's a tip-tipa. It's only the beginning. It's the beginning of a process that's developing. We just celebrated 70 years of statehood. 70 is very young, right? If you come here to the OU Center and you're only 70, you're one of the youngsters, you know? Right? You're only 70? That's, you know, that's young. That's young. 70 is the new 40, right? 70 is young. It's a young state. And we have to recognize that look how far we've come. Yes, there's a lot more to go, a lot more to do, but look how far we've come in 70 years. It's a tremendous blessing. You have to feel that blessing. I describe often the state of Israel as an atar b'niya. It's a construction site. It's a work in progress. I've only been living here 10 years. Many of you have been living here much longer than I. And you've seen the tremendous flowering and blossoming that's taking place here in Jerusalem and throughout the country. It's a tremendous, tremendous zchut to be living here today. And I think it's significant that Rav Kook, in trying to justify how we can establish a modern government in our ancient land and build a modern democracy here in the land of Israel, I think it's significant that he draws upon the Hashmoneim. It was a less than ideal circumstance, but there's the ideal and then there's the reality. We should be zoche, ultimately, to see the complete redemption with the building of the Holy Temple. B'meher v'meinu amein, speedily in our days. Have a great day, a great week, and please God, Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll see you next Sunday. Yeah.
I wrote to Rabbi Kook, this whole story, about coming up to deliver. Uh-huh. He asked Rabbi Kook for a blessing. He says, you need a blessing? Rabbi Kook replied, surprise. After all, you merited to ascend to the land of Israel, a whole land with financial security.
Wow. That was enough. That's a blessing. Wow, that's quite a blessing.